Kamenetsky Brothers Podcast, Brian Kamenetsky, Andy Kamenetsky coming to you. It is
Friday, March 3rd.
It is Friday, March 3rd. It's good to be in March, Andy. I'm excited.
Except for the Ides.
Yes.
The Ides make you a little nervous.
Watch out for the Ides, but mm-hmm. Once you get past the Ides of March, then the rest is pretty smooth.
Whole thing's great.
Pretty smooth sailing. We've also reached the part of the NBA season where the stories about the Lakers, now that the Magic stuff has kind of died down a little bit, the stories about the Lakers are far less interesting than the stories about everything else. So the big NBA news this week really has not much to do with the Lakers. So we're going to reverse our normal process here and do the big NBA headlines after we talk Lakers.
No, man, we don't have to explain ourselves to anybody, man. This is our own damn
podcast.
I'm
not justifying it. I'm just like, people might say, did I skip around? Did I do it wrong or something like that?
You know what I say? Double middle fingers, bleep them, man.
You want people to live by the seat of their
pants.
No,
I'm just saying, man, you want a podcast in your own specific order? Do your own damn podcast. Make it good enough that you and I listen to it.
There are some nervous people who like podcasts, and they're very routinized.
Let me tell you something. These people have a lot more things to be nervous about these days than the order with which we
do
things on our podcast.
The flip side of that is when things in the real world get dicier, sometimes you cling to those things that you...
We are here to tell all those people nothing's getting better.
And moving on. Your update for this week, it's still bad.
Yes,
your update for next week, still bad.
Spoiler alert.
It's bad.
Our podcast, if we record on March 10th,
bad.
No better. March 17th, still bad.
All right, well, that was gloomy.
Let's move forward.
The Lakers, what we've seen from them, they've lost a couple games since the last time we recorded. They're going to lose. It's similar to what we just talked about. They're going to lose a few more between now and then. They've traded Lou Williams, and the big question becomes what happens to them going forward? Who picks up the slack, particularly in fourth quarters, and what does this mean? I think we can all agree the Lakers are significantly worse without Lou Williams.
Yeah. I mean, forget the Lakers' dependence on Lou Williams, particularly in the fourth quarter. Lou Williams has been one of the best fourth quarter players
in the league.
In the NBA this
right,
year.
Right, for sure.
I mean, these couple seasons with the Lakers, I think have been probably Lou Williams' best two seasons of his career. I mean, he's really been good for this team, and thus far, he is not missing a beat with the Rockets.
No, he's played well for them, which you'd expect. That's a fish in water type situation for
Lou. And also, too, Lou is one of those guys that I don't think gets particularly nervous about a new setting. As Lou often, you know, remember when the trade deadline?
No, Lou gonna Lou.
When the trade deadline was approaching, yeah. You know, you always ask guys, you know, are you thinking about it? Is it a distraction? And most guys admit, yeah, it's hard when you hear your name in rumors. Lou's response, and I think he was being 100% true, I'm just going
to
hoop.
Yep. And if Lou was traded to Houston, which he was, like, that's a perfect fit. Like,
sure.
Mike D'Antoni, Lou Williams, that makes sense. But if Lou was traded to Utah, he'd still Lou.
And you know what?
Lou's going to Lou.
If the Nets had traded for Lou Williams,
he'd be Louing over there.
He'd hoop.
It's a verb.
Yep.
So, you know, but statistically, the Lakers were, you know, in terms of differentials and things like that, basically level with Lou Williams on the floor. It's slightly worse, but basically level. Without him, they were like 12.5 points worse per 100 possessions and all that, which by far led the team. So, you know, they've won 19 games right now as we're talking.
Yep.
Stuck there. Could be stuck for a little while. That 19 games was propped up in part by Lou Williams.
Yes, it was.
And now he's gone.
Yep.
This is not necessarily a bad thing to be significantly worse. You know, lotteries and all
sure.
that.
Yeah. Plus, at the end of the day, this was not a team set up to win a lot of games in a year. It's all about development, and that development can, in some ways, hopefully get accelerated
right.
without Lou Williams there.
And so the fourth quarter question really comes down to two players. It's D'Angelo Russell and it's Jordan Clarkson. We have a lot of Russell stuff to get to. So let's start with Clarkson, because he, to me, is the guy who is most directly impacted by the trade for Williams. And I talked to Walton about that earlier in the week.
What's different about what's available for Jordan in terms of his responsibilities, what's open for him, all that, with Lou gone? How does that change?
Well, he's been the primary ball handler, that second group. And I think he's doing a really good job with it. And I think with most players, the more responsibility you give them, they kind of start playing better all over the court. I think it's he's elevated his defensive game. He's been trying to play make and get guys involved more. So I think he's done a nice job of you know, trying to pick up some of the slack of trying to compete without Lou out there.
I think there's before there was a sense from him that, like, well, he's handling the ball, so my job is to go score or something. Kind of dribble.
Because he's got a scoring mentality. Right. He's a scoring guard. So if the possessions are going to be limited, you know, his mindset is let's get this thing in the basket. And I think now he's able to do a more more balanced type of attack. While
is there
he's
sort of some tunnel vision though with him, where he can just kind of pound out possessions?
Well, he's
before. I mean,
no, he still does, and I think what we're trying to get him to do is to be able to, because we'll tell him to be unselfish, and then he'll get tunnel vision as far as trying to drive and pass every time. And he has good passing games when he plays like that, but it affects his scoring. And then when he, you know, sometimes when he's tunnel vision scoring, it'll affect his passing. So what we're trying to get is for him to not predetermine what he's going to do and to just let the game come to him. And I think he's done a really nice job with that lately.
All right, so that was Luke Walton earlier this week talking about Jordan Clarkson. And yeah, I don't think the Lou Williams being as good as he was, Andy, was bad for Clarkson, because Clarkson kind of does what Lou does, and then the rest of Clarkson's job is sort of taken up by Nick Young, except Lou was way better at it. And so to me, it always felt like Clarkson was sort of marginalized and felt like, okay, well, Lou's doing this, so I got to go do this. I got to go score. I got to justify every possession I have the ball by putting it in the hole, which meant a lot of dribbling, like a significant amount of dribbling. And overall, I think that's part of the reason that I don't think he has progressed as much this year as some of the other guys.
I agree with you to a point. I don't think it's the only reason. And,
no, I agree.
And I say this just to be fair to Clarkson. As much as I think, and you and I have talked about this a lot with Travis Rogers during pre- and post-game for the Lakers at ESPN LA 710, some of this, I think, is legitimately Clarkson. When you look at the young core, I think his game has progressed or evolved the least of all these guys. I mean, even D'Angelo Russell, with his inconsistencies,
correct.
I think has still evolved more.
And I think some of that is the limitations of Clarkson.
And also, too, I do think with Clarkson, some of it is he has never been asked to do the same thing every year. Like, his role keeps changing from his rookie season, when Byron Scott pretty much had no other choice but to use him in the second half of the season, and he was this quasi point guard, to being more of a combo guard, to being in the second season, to being whatever the hell he is this year. It hasn't been the same season to season to season. And for young players to develop, a foundation of consistency really matters.
Yeah, for sure. And look, I mean, I'm looking it up now. I think he's 24, isn't he?
Give or take.
And it sounds silly to talk this way, but the metrics kind of keep showing, like, once you get to 23, 24, 25, you can improve in different ways, and guys, you know, will develop a skill set or whatever it might be. But yeah, he's 24. He'll turn 25 in June. So, you know, but you are kind of what you are at this point.
Yeah. There are exceptions. A guy like Kyle Lowry clearly bloomed in his late 20s, early 30s.
Right.
But generally speaking,
Steph wasn't Steph when he showed up in the league.
But generally speaking, you are correct.
So, you know, I think what Luke's saying is, like, what they hope is that by giving him more to do, by putting the ball in his hands more often, making him the guy who runs the pick and roll and all this other stuff, it will help round out that game. Because, you know, the part that I thought was interesting was two parts about that. First was when he said, when I was like, you know, before, would he pound out possessions? It's like, oh, no, he still does that. And that's something we've seen. But that the tunnel vision goes back and forth. It's not so much that he won't pass or that he's exclusively focused on shooting, is that he struggles to do both, to kind of see the floor that way. It's a different version of the problems that Russell has, where he can do both and he's trying to figure out which one to do. Clarkson, I guess, has trouble doing one and the other.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, Clarkson really is just more of a natural scorer than he is a natural floor general.
There's no question.
He's a guy. We mentioned before Lou Williams, and you said that, you know, he's somebody who can do what Lou does, but not as well. Lou Williams can, in a pinch, run an offense, and he can, if you need him to, at times set up other guys. It's not what Lou does best. And it's not even because Lou Williams is a selfish player or anything like that. It's just Lou Williams' natural instincts and his natural skill set is to score.
Right.
And when you ask him to move out of that skill set, it's not that he can't do it, but we've seen, as well as Lou played with the Lakers, those times where the shots aren't falling, he doesn't bring a ton else.
He doesn't, no. It's certainly not, you know, I know we complain about Clarkson's defense, but it's, you know, at least he's working at it better than Lou did. But I look, Clarkson just, in that young core of guys, I think Clarkson has shown himself, this is what he is. Clarkson is a very, potentially very effective sixth man. Instant scorer off the bench.
And there ain't nothing wrong
with that. There's nothing wrong with that, particularly for what they're paying him and the age he is and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, really what's going to keep him from being great at that role is free throws. He doesn't get to the line. He has a remarkable inability to draw fouls.
And that's
the biggest difference between him and Lou as a scorer. Beyond the Lou's ability to, you know, Jedi mind trick people and all that stuff, Lou is good for 6 or 7 points a game from the free throw line.
Yeah, and you know, it's remarkable in the sense that I really have no idea why it happens, because it's not like Jordan Clarkson doesn't go to the basket. Like, it's one of those things, and I mean, maybe you need to watch the tape more. I'd love to talk maybe to one of the coaches. Is it a matter of he doesn't attack enough in traffic? Does he not attack in a certain way that he's going to get the benefit of the doubt? Is it he hasn't been in the league long enough to make referees respect him? Like, I don't know what it is, because it's not like you're looking at a pure jump shooter and then the reasons he doesn't get fouls are obvious.
Well, I mean, it's something we can look into, you know, with Luke and all that. But I think some of it is great scorers. Look at Harden. Look at Lou. It's not just attack. It's attack and change speeds.
Yeah.
It's attack and change directions. It's
and Lou
the
is a
angles
master
and all
at that.
It's all the little angles and the subtle things you do. And Clarkson tends to go at one speed.
Yeah.
So you know, he's an interesting guy to watch. I think obviously he's going to be on the floor more in fourth quarters, and will be a person who is relied on to score and create and do all that. Because part of the problem when you look at the Lakers down the stretch, and it was an issue Charlotte, where they just stopped scoring in the fourth quarter. They don't have creators. They traded their shot creator to Houston. Clarkson doesn't really do it very well because it takes him so long to pound out of possession. Russell can create a little bit, but
he's not at Lou Williams' level. You don't clear the floor
on one side and let D'Angelo create. You set a screen for him and let him get in the lane that way.
Randall, you have to get the ball. Unless he starts off a defensive rebound, you have to get the ball too.
And Randall in isolation, particularly with his back to the basket, is a dicey proposition too. So how the Lakers go forward, and this gets to the next conversation, which, you know, to me, and I think to most people, it becomes a Russell question of
what's he going to do?
You know, what can the Lakers do, and what is he going to do in the fourth quarter to facilitate for himself and to get other people
shot? Actually, before we even get into the Russell conversation, I think it's actually really interesting just talking about this fourth quarter dynamic in general, because I actually, after the Charlotte game, asked Luke sort of what he was expecting with Lou gone, because this was the first game since the Williams trade that was actually close in the fourth quarter where you'd even have to think about
it. Right, the first one didn't help.
Right, and Luke said, I like to organically let it happen as far as the way the game's going, who's having a great game. On a lot of teams, it's pretty obvious who that is, but with us, I'm not going to force it to make one guy do it. And then he was talking about how with this team, often the guy, besides Lou Williams, the guy taking over in the fourth quarter, taking a lot of shots in the fourth quarter with the young guys, was whoever was having a really good game. Like, if D'Angelo's feeling it, he's going to keep putting up shots. If Randall, Clarkson, same thing. Maybe Brandon Ingram, too. And Luke said he's looking for guys to start taking those shots in the fourth quarter in a game when they're 4 of 17.
Oh, for sure.
Right now, I think part of what Luke is doing in letting it happen organically as opposed to trying to orchestrate a pecking order is he's testing all these guys.
I agree with you, and that's kind of where I was going, though.
I think
D'Angelo Russell has to be the front of that pecking order, because I don't think the other options are capable of creating those opportunities for
that's
themselves.
That's fine, but I think some of it,
that's
though,
what I'm getting at.
Oh, sure, but I think even beyond what you're getting at, and you're correct, some of it has to do, I think what Luke is looking at is, okay, who avoids the game of hot potato?
That may, okay, that's a different
what
question.
I'm talking about.
That's
is,
a different question.
Just in that fourth quarter dynamic, you know, you are correct that D'Angelo Russell is going to be better at orchestrating looks either for himself or other guys than anybody on this team. But we've seen at times when some of these young guys are struggling, they'll pass up a shot. You know, we've seen it on more than a few occasions.
It's happened, yeah,
this
for
year.
Sure.
And Luke is definitely right now trying to suss out who's going to be looking up to put up those shots, again, especially when they're not playing well.
And, you know, there are a lot of nights where they aren't. well, just so they're not, it's not a high efficiency squad we're dealing with here. I mean, so this all reminds me of last year, because everything in the end seems to be code for D'Angelo.
Sure.
You can put, you know, what you're talking about, attitude, this, that, when you can call him at whatever. It still always seems to matter more if D'Angelo is good than if the other guys are doing. I mean, I think they need Ingram to grow into something metaphorically and literally grow into something bigger than he is now. And Randall has kind of teased people, I think, with what his top-end potential is going to be. But it still goes back to, is D'Angelo Russell going to be the kind of point guard that is sort of Mike Conley, somewhere between Mike Conley and Chris Paul, or is he going to be, you know, in terms of overall effectiveness and transformational power, Ricky Rubio?
Right.
Good player, but one where you are constantly aware that you can do a lot better.
Right. There is a reason Ricky Rubio, as much as he can bring to the table defensively and as a passer, has been like publicly on the block for like 4 years.
Right. Because he's just got obvious deficiencies that are so obvious. And though his
and they're clearly never going to get
and they're not. And his deficiencies aren't Russell's. And so I don't mean it as like a, you know, Russell
A-to-A
is
comparison.
Right. But the point being,
sure,
you look at Rubio and know you can do better, despite the fact that he's going to be, he could play in the league for 17 years.
He's a good player.
He's a good player. Some of this gets back to his attitude and whether the body language and all that kind of stuff. And so when people talk about Russell and fourth quarters and leadership and all this other stuff, he's going to have to take the onus of what happens in the fourth. And the Lakers are going to have to give it to him because there's nobody else to do it. Unless I'm missing something. I don't want to clear the floor for Jordan Clarkson on one side of that. That is a bad way to try to score points. Because, again,
first of all, you're going to have 24-second violations.
Right, and he doesn't
He's just
going to
keep pounding.
I don't want Young to do it because that is pointless.
It's absolute. I mean, Nick Young is the one guy they know will always put up those shots.
He'll put them up, but he can't create them.
But it doesn't matter.
Right.
Like at this point, they're not looking to suss out what they have in Nick Young. I think they know. Like
we
that,
all do. Isn't it cool?
It is, but that's not the point.
It's not the point. And so it's got to be Russell. And you know, the leadership question, and people are going to want him to be aggressive and do the stuff in the fourth quarter. It didn't really work until the end of the Charlotte game. He was balling
in
the third,
was.
Though.
Yes, he was.
And so you sort of see what it looks like. The leadership thing is probably most to me where I think he can learn from Magic, because it's not a question of read the screen. I think he does that stuff pretty well. It's body language. It's attitude. It's when you put your arm around this guy, when you push that guy. I don't think he's all that good at that stuff yet.
Yeah, you know,
he doesn't look right.
The word I would use, because I keep hearing it come up, whether from Luke or from other guys and talking about D'Angelo with leadership, is accountability. And just the idea of, okay, this is on me. Like, it is on me to get the best out of everybody else.
He says right. The right stuff.
And by the way, I mean,
it's not that I think he understands at the very least that's what he's supposed to say.
He understands it, but I think, and you know, maybe this is, you know, a double-edged sword when it came to the accountability that you and I both were pretty impressed that he showed with after, you know, Snapchat gate with Nick Young and Iggy last year. You and I both thought that
he knew he'd done bleeped up.
Yeah, but you and I thought that he both handled that situation very well. He took tons and tons of questions from the media, more than we expected. And he said all the right things, but you also wonder if that became an exercise in learning how to say the right things. And I've heard before that there are some concerns that D'Angelo doesn't necessarily know all the right things to do or doesn't necessarily prioritize doing them. He just knows how to say it.
Yeah,
and there's an accountability.
Yes.
I think on, you know, on several different fronts, that if D'Angelo starts showing, I think those leadership qualities you're talking about are going to start exhibiting themselves. They're going to start shining through more.
The thing about him, we've mentioned this, I think, on airwaves, but like it, I always think it matters that you remember that different guys do this in different ways. They grow up faster. Some, I have no idea if D'Angelo Russell is ever going to be like sort of a like Chris Paul level of responsible, you know, Chris Paul level of maturity and all that. He may never get there. But he's 21, and not all 21-year-olds are created equal. And Julius Randle, by the way, who Walton congratulated after the Charlotte game, like, this is as hard as he's played all year. Like, Randle looks, and this is part of it. Like, remember we talked about, like, how every seventh at-bat, no matter the result, J.D. Drew, when he used to play for the Dodgers, should smash a water cooler.
Right.
Because then everybody would think he cares.
Right.
And so much of this is just the aesthetics of it. Randle looks like hustle. Almost all the time, even when the coaches think he's not working nearly as hard as he should be, to the sort of casual observer, he's always, because it's, you know, offensive rebounds and he's up and down the floor and he's, and it just like everything, there's no fluidity to anything he does anyway, so it always looks harder. Russell's that opposite, on the opposite end of the spectrum. He's much more that J.D. Drew, very smooth. It's a, nothing looks hurried. And so when you play that way, and there's nothing wrong with playing that way in that kind of controlled way.
To a point.
To a point
because they actually want him to speed it up.
Well, no, but I'm not talking about going too slow. I'm talking about looking constantly but like you're in control.
I know, but I think that they actually
– No, they won't pick it up.
Right, but I think some of that control, I think they think impedes him actually playing at the pace that they want.
That's fine.
That's the only
that's fine. But I just the optics of how Russell plays – make you think, and because he's not Westbrook and he's not that kind of athlete, it's easier for him to fall into the trap of he's not really working hard, he doesn't care, he's not trying that hard, which sometimes may be true, or he's not working hard enough. It's hard for players to learn, okay, I think I'm going at 100%, and my 100% is 80 at this
Look,
league.
Man, that's hard in any profession. Yes. I mean, there are times where I feel like I've busted my ass either prepping for a show or on something that I've been writing.
I can tell you most of the time,
it's ineffective.
It does not show.
It's not nearly
as much as
I should do. It
really doesn't show in the way that I think you're hoping.
I could always do it
more. I mean, look, I can't imagine what it would look like if you did none of that. I mean, my God, it would be a dumpster fire.
Yes, it would.
But you're right. I mean, it's hard to know because there's always somebody that's going to be working more than you. And so when you combine the fact that he plays the point guard for the Lakers, he's the spot – the first real spotlight guy that they drafted, because he came before Ingram. It was the first, you know, number two pick. They took him instead of Porzingis in the revisionist history model.
He's also, too, at a position that, save Nick Van Exel, they have had nobody potentially great at since the guy who is now in charge of basketball operations.
Right. And,
I mean, you're talking
yes.
like a 20-ish year gap.
Between really effective
right,
point
without,
guard.
Without anybody who comes even close right. to filling that bill, other than, again, maybe Nick Van Exel, who certainly left L.A. not on the greatest of terms.
And then you combine that with the fact, and I do not want to make this all about external Russell stuff or whatever, he is a cocky son of a I mean, he really is. I mean, he is a hard person to like in some ways, you know? He makes it harder for, I don't care, but he makes it harder for the conversation around him than he needs to.
Well, I'll tell you too, what I think is really funny, I know we've talked about this before, the ice in my veins is like the ultimate example of a prism of how we, the royal we, see D'Angelo Russell.
Right.
Because when he's playing great, everybody loves ice in my veins. They want to see that. You know, we've seen a couple fans at the game sink half-court shots or whatever.
And
ice in my veins. When D'Angelo is playing badly, it's this little bleep hole, you know, doing his stupid ice in the veins. You know,
and look, I mean, it was a
little punk,
in the
man.
Grand
he needs to worry about other
right.
things.
Right. I mean, you look at it and you say, all right, son, you know, you just want to, you just managed to sink a huge shot to win your team's, what was it, like, eighth game of the year.
But I'm just saying,
you've
though,
lost 77% of your games.
It's just indicative
as a pro.
Of how we see him.
Right.
That's all I'm
it's
saying.
It's just like, we don't, you better be good all the time if you're not going to be consistently humble.
Yeah.
And, you know, D'Angelo doesn't play in a sort of a flashy way, you know, way like he jumps off the page, but there is a swagger to the way he passes, to the way, like, his follow-through when he passes, the way he looks off a pass. I mean, he carries himself in a certain way that is cocky. He just is. Doesn't mean he can't be good. So, you know, the leadership stuff, I just think that's what Magic needs to teach him, is to, you know, body language, how you walk, when you little stuff like that would make a huge difference.
Let me look.
I think overall his play, I don't have a problem with it.
Say what you will about how you feel about Magic taking over basketball operations. We had this discussion on the last podcast. Magic knows what it means to put out good body language. He knows what it means to understand how people see you.
Yes, and like what
and
it
he's
is
a
to,
master at it.
To galvanize a team. When he jumps into Kareem's arms after that first game as a rookie, you know, he got made fun of, and it was, but it said something about him. All right, so that'll be something to look at. And I, you know, Russell and Clarkson are getting a ton of shots between now and the end of the year, and I think that's something that people are looking forward to. That's really it. It's your Lakers issues, Andy.
I mean, we covered a lot of them with Magic and the whole front office facelift
been,
and stuff like that.
We
went pretty in depth.
Around the league, the big news, unless I'm missing something. Kevin Durant got hurt.
Yeah.
Like, bad.
Yeah.
Not catastrophically bad. Not, oh, bleep, the season is ruined and the postseason's going to suck now. Kind of bad.
But
bad.
Bad enough that you are concerned about the postseason.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a given that he's going to be back for the postseason.
Right. So it's a bone bruise.
And an MCL sprain.
They're going to reevaluate in 4 weeks.
Right.
He'll probably miss the rest of the regular season. And then, or maybe get a game or two.
I think the first round of the playoffs right now is considered potentially in jeopardy.
I think they think he'll be back for the playoffs, but they're not.
I think the second round, if you start getting into that being in jeopardy, then you're looking at an injury of like, oh man, this is worse than we even thought.
Right.
It was.
And so, look, the Warriors still have Clay, and they have Steph, and they have Draymond, and they have Iggy, and they signed Matt Barnes, and they were very good last year. But last year, they also had Andrew Bogut, who was an important part of that, as we learned in the finals. They had Harrison Barnes, who wasn't great, but he was still good enough to matter. And if, you know, you trade up for KD, but if KD's not there, then not having Harrison Barnes matters. You had Festus Ezeli gave them some minutes. Leandro Barbosa gave them some minutes. Maury Spates gave them some minutes. You know, so they don't have, they were much more top heavy this year than they were last year. And now when you take one of those components away, they're going to be really good, but they're not.
It's not.
They feel
just
a lot more vulnerable.
I'll tell you, Brian, they do. And it's vulnerable being all relative. I mean, they're still going to be a very good team. But it's not just a matter of taking away one of their four stars. They're taking away their star who's having the best season of those four.
Yes, it's been real good.
And it's not even close. Durant is averaging, I'm rounding these numbers, but 25, 8, and 5, a steal, and 1.5 blocks per game.
Right, and he's shooting like 55%.
He's shooting 54% from the field, 38 from three. He's got a 27.6 per. His true shooting percentage is 65%. It's the best in the league among non-big men. He leads the Warriors in points, in rebounds, in blocks, the best points per shot per game. He leads them in total plus minus. He's second on the team in offensive and defensive. He leads them in win shares. His defense has been phenomenal.
Yeah, it's been much. I mean,
like he's the rim protector that they thought they'd be missing
in
both.
He's added that to his game, for
but
sure.
But here's the other thing, too. Like, you go from a situation where Kevin Durant was this obvious upgrade from Harrison Barnes. There's no question, even taking into account how
I think Harrison Barnes would agree.
Right.
I think Harrison Barnes' mom would agree.
Right. Even taking into account that Barnes is playing really well in Dallas, it's not even close.
Yeah, Kevin Durant.
But once you sub in Matt Barnes, then all of a sudden, forget the downgrade from Kevin Durant. You're going from a downgrade from Harrison Barnes.
Yeah. I mean, look,
I'd rather have Harrison Barnes than Matt Barnes.
I think Matt Barnes will end up playing a lot of minutes.
Yes, he will.
I think he's going to end up playing a lot of minutes. And I think he fits in there because he doesn't have to score. He'll hit a corner three from that. He'll get 5 or 6 rebounds. He'll get a few assists. In a lot of ways, he's kind of a Iggy-like stat stuffer who will move the ball and do all the little things, and he fits in really well there.
He does. I don't disagree.
But he's not that good.
Again, if you had to choose between Harrison Barnes or Matt Barnes, which you take
it? Well, it depends what I need, but probably Harrison.
From the role of Harrison Barnes last year, I would rather have Harrison Barnes than Matt Barnes.
But it's closer than you think. at least I think, it's, you know, for all the little stuff and whatever, I think Matt Barnes might actually be a better fit. Harrison Barnes is probably a better defender.
I think he's a better defender. I think he's more versatile. He's a better shooter.
Yeah. Well, not the version they got in the finals. That
no,
sucked.
But generally speaking, he's a better shooter. Matt Barnes is probably a better ball mover.
Vulnerability, yeah, he is. The vulnerability part is interesting because so much of this stuff is mental. Like, if you go in and you're playing the Warriors, you know, even if you think you're a really good team, you know, but like, you're really going to beat Clay, Steph, Draymond, and Kevin effing Durant four times in seven games on their floor, like when we know we got to go to their floor. Like, I know we're good, but are we that good? And all of a sudden, like, sports are weird. Sports are all about, you know, the making your world the best of all possible worlds. And guys twist themselves into pretzels with logic that makes no sense to play that game. Now you have an opening. Well, okay, well, you know, they don't have all those guys from last year. We can keep, you know, Clay misses some shots. Steph misses some shots. Steph, you know, Clay's 10 for his last 42 from the field. You know, Steph against
Steph's
the Bulls.
Been in a slump lately.
Yep, Steph against the Bulls on Thursday. They only scored 87 points.
And like, if you hear, if you listen to people,
23 points on 27 shots.
And if you listen to people who cover the Warriors, they will all say Steph has not been himself this season. I mean, he's still been good. But
some
he's
of
not
that
maybe
because of KD's presence, and all that. And what did we learn over the last couple playoffs? Steph is, you know, seven games, if you just whack on him over and over and over and over again, he becomes less effective, which makes sense. He's 4.5 feet tall and weighs 53 pounds. You beat him down. So I just feel like mentally a team would look at this injury, and if he doesn't come back for a first round or he's diminished or whatever it might be.
Like, they're still going to be Denver in the first round, but do you automatically.
Although, I've said all year long I'm going to die on the Denver Nuggets hill, and I'm happy that
I've been dying on that Portland hill, and I feel like I'm really dying.
Your hill's in trouble. You picked a bad hill.
My hill's about to get
my
taken
hill
over.
Is doing much better
my
than
my hill's
your
getting
hill.
Stormed.
I want, as much as I want to see like Jokic in the playoffs, and he's so awesome and all this stuff, and I think Denver's pretty good, like for a bad team. I want the Pelicans to get in,
right?
Because that becomes an intriguing.
Sure.
Because the, you know, Boogie has beaten up on Golden State.
Well, the Pelicans need to win games with the two of them on the floor before they start working about making the playoffs.
They got to figure out that. But I'm saying if they could somehow, it makes it a much more interesting. At least you could look at it and be like, well, the one thing that they're probably more vulnerable to is size, and they have these two guys. I'd watch that.
But either way, it feels pretty foregone that no matter who the Warriors play in the first round, even without Durant, they're going to win that series. But you go into a second round with either no Durant or Durant, who's clearly feeling
off
the effects.
Yeah.
Is it an absolute given that that team beats Utah or the Clippers? They're still favored, but it doesn't feel as much a given.
I agree with you. And now that takes us to Cleveland. Because they've added Deron Williams, and they picked up Bogut. And, you know, Williams isn't the D-Will that he used to be. You know, when we used to have a debate, you know, who's better, Deron Williams or Chris Paul? I think the answer is Chris Paul.
State Farm certainly.
That's
decided.
Right. But he's still pretty good. He's sort of quietly over
the
last
way,
couple
just
seasons.
By the way, quick side note, as great as Chris Paul is on the floor, these State Farm commercials have demonstrated he is a mess in his personal life. Like, everything that guy
it's
does
very
around
dysfunctional.
His home
he's
just falls apart.
Trees falling on him. He tried to build that treehouse.
And he's
and
cheap,
part.
Too, man. He keeps hiring DeAndre Jordan and Damian Lillard to do all the work around his house.
He's got that weird-looking baby.
Man, makes a lot of money.
He's got a son who can't stop throwing dimes out of a sunroof.
Pony up for some professionals.
I do like those commercials, though.
I'm ready for that campaign.
I am. Man. I mean, I think they had a good run, but yeah. They're generally pretty funny.
Continue.
Anyway, you know, D. Will has been kind of quietly pretty good over the last couple of years, and he doesn't have to be great. He just has to be better than who they had, and who they had was like Kay Felder.
Yeah. Well, who they really had was LeBron.
Right.
That's actually who they had was LeBron.
They really didn't have a backup
point guard. And it led to LeBron being on the floor just insane amounts of minutes this year. Because Ty Lue apparently really wants that one seed and will not tell LeBron you need to step off the floor. But just D. Will and even Bogut to some degree being able to make plays for other guys.
Not even to some degree. It's a huge part of what they're going to be able to do. And you know, it'll take them a little while to figure out lineups and all this other stuff. And they're going to get less pressure on them from Toronto because Kyle Lowry's out and Boston, they got enough. They've got enough flexibility that the one seed's important.
Sucks for Toronto, by
really
the way.
Does.
I mean,
he needs to come back because the Eastern Conference playoffs are going to be totally boring if Toronto isn't Toronto.
Although
that team with Ibaka and PJ Tucker. I will watch that.
And you and I too, we've talked about this year. Both of us wanted to see Toronto go for it and try to make some moves. You know, does that make them better than Cleveland? No, but like particularly if you're the Toronto Raptors and it's not like you get the pick of the litter for free agents and stuff like that. If you've got a legit opportunity, take it.
Well,
and
look,
I like seeing them take it.
And nobody roots for anybody to get hurt. But you know they're like, somebody's like, yeah, did you hear what happened? A superstar went down and you're like, you know in their locker room, like in the part of their mind they would never admit to, they were like, please be LeBron. Please be LeBron. Please be. Oh, man, it's KD.
Right.
That sucks for them. That doesn't help me at all. You know, because that's why you do it. You load up because weird stuff happens. Right. And you take.
Well, you don't know what Kevin Love's going to look like when he gets back. You don't know what J.R. Smith is going to look like when he gets back.
I think you do.
Well, okay, you don't know how good he's going to look. You do know
exactly. I think you know
exactly
what he's going to look like and how it's going to play and all that.
And
I know exactly what it's going to be when J.R. Smith
comes
back.
Won't even have a shirt on.
But you know, you take D. Will and Bogut make a big difference
for
that team. They've loaded up and they won last year, and so that becomes
also.
I
think the biggest difference those guys make is hopefully. If everybody just uses common sense, they prevent LeBron from potentially hitting that wall.
Right,
because I think that is a big threat with them this year.
Because even if he's going to play and he's going to be on the floor for 37 minutes, five more possessions a game where D. Will does the facilitating of the offense and he can finish it, or just stand in the corner and rest for 10 seconds, which is a lot of what happens.
No, I know.
I'm going to take this possession off defensively. Well, as the games get more important, it's harder to do that defensively, but okay, I'll take the offensive possession off because Bogut can do out of this and whatever. And you only need 17 to 22 minutes of Andrew Bogut and focus Bogut, despite that picture that's been going around on the internet where he looks like he's 95 years old.
He looks like
Lincoln at the end of his, like at the, you know, right before he got shot.
He looks like a wax museum version of Andrew Bogut.
Like a melty wax, like a wax museum where
they
air conditioner,
the
right? It's been, oh man, like as an intern, he's going to get fired.
I
am in deep trouble. That's what he looks like in that one picture, which is really a shame.
It's
it was
uncomfortable.
A tough moment. But
you know
despite
what it's sort
that,
of like? It's like, remember, you and I did
he does
a
have a
recent,
very Lincoln-y look.
You and I did a recent show, I think filling in for Thompson Trudell.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed in talking about how.
Oh, yeah, with LeBron.
LeBron, if you look at LeBron's photo for his stats page on ESPN, and every year they do a different photo. LeBron looks tired in that photo, and that was a preseason photo.
Yeah.
That wasn't even LeBron during the season.
He should be more
like, I'm
perky.
Telling you, LeBron has been to six straight finals. He looks tired.
He's going to sleep for a long time once it's all over.
He's going to sleep when he's dead, which may be soon.
Hopefully that all comes together. Hopefully KD, it's closer to that four-week thing, and he's back on the floor, because you don't want the injuries to mess with the playoffs.
No.
You just don't.
Not at
all. I want to see Houston. I mean, Houston, Golden State could be a fun series. I think
you want Durant back.
I don't think anybody
want
wants to play
back.
Utah if they're healthy.
Back.
The Western Conference outside of the eight seed actually got some intriguing. Like the Clippers, because of the way they've fallen, now all of a sudden become like a really frightening potential six seed.
And
I wouldn't want to play
and
them.
And in the meantime, too, I think in the East with like the early rounds.
They're going to be the second round and on.
Second round
and
on. I mean, Washington's
Washington,
playing
Chicago,
really well.
Washington, Toronto,
Boston, Cleveland.
Four legitimate teams.
Those could be really good series. Again, assuming
Washington's been one of the best teams in the league over the last 2 months.
Right, they just picked
up
Brandon Jennings, who, by the way, I think is
and
probably excited out of his
Bojan
mind.
Bojan Bogdanovic.
Excited out of his mind to no longer be a Knick.
He was always a good fit for the triangle.
Speaking of which,
it was a professional seg.
They're running the triangle.
Yeah, they're
now.
Going back to the triangle.
Yeah.
And Jeff Hornacek has not wanted to use the word triangle very much this year, and everybody else doesn't want to use the word triangle. But they're adding more triangle elements, Andy. And interestingly enough, and this actually, it's being mocked in New York more than I think it should. The biggest reason that they're introducing more triangle, need more triangle, is to help their defense. The thinking being a more structured offense, and this is something that Phil talked about all the time in when he was here. You know, better defense can mean better offense, or better offense can mean better defense.
Yes.
The more structure they hope will make them better defensively.
The more your offense falls apart, the more your defense becomes vulnerable.
And
also, too, if you ask Charlie Rosen, the triangle is the best way to utilize the talents of Sasha Vujacic.
It does figure out a way to get Sasha back in the
game. What's the name of that? It's like Fan Rag Sports or something. Just Google Charlie Rosen, Sasha Vujacic.
Oh, yeah, there it is.
Charlie Rosen, who I think everybody knows, is basically speaking for Phil at this point in ways that Phil can't do.
He is Phil's Sean Spicer.
He's his Cyrano. One of the things Charlie Rosen just wrote about in cutting Brandon Jennings, the reason they did that is in very large part it helps unleash the magic that is Sasha Vujacic,
veteran. It's going to mean more opportunities for Sasha to get on the floor.
He described in this piece Sasha Vujacic as a proven shot maker. I was like, get the bleep out of here.
I mean, he's made
Rose.
Shots. I don't think Sasha necessarily fits
he's
in that category anymore.
He's not a proven shot maker.
Certainly not anymore.
You ask Laker fans on the in the aggregate if they thought of Sasha as a proven shot maker.
I think he was a proven hairband wearer.
He's a proven
annoyance. Volleyball lover, beach volleyball lover. Proven vintner at this point.
Yes. He better be. His least expensive bottle's like $75.
But he's a proven shot maker. It's an optimistic view of Sasha Vujacic that I don't think is necessarily shared by Knicks fans.
No.
One of the things I never understood about the triangle is if you asked the coaches about like what is it, and there are principles and this and that, everything seemed to be triangle. Like, what if you want to do that's the triangle. But what about this? No, that's also, but like this thing is the opposite of that thing. That's fine. It's still the triangle. Like, I feel like it becomes a catch-all for like every single thing you can do with a basketball.
Except for basically put Kobe
on one wing and let him ice.
It's the Xerox of basketball.
I'm missing some nuance.
It's the
cleaner,
the Kleenex of basketball.
And, you know, but the Knicks could use a little something. Not sure that's it. But the biggest thing they got to do, you got to pick a lane. You gotta decide. You can't be, you know, half one kind of team, half another kind of team. You know, the Lakers went through this, where they got Mike D'Antoni, but they gave him a roster of dudes who didn't necessarily fit that system. Then you go, you know, you go to the next guy and you give, you know, Byron Scott, and what do? You give him a bunch of young people, and we all know Byron Scott hates children, and so that didn't work. I mean, you pick something and be that thing, but the problem is, the thing that they want to be doesn't work because they have Carmelo Anthony.
Well, it doesn't work, too, because you have a lot of players who have been coached throughout their entire careers going back to high school in ways that don't fit for what you want to do with the triangle.
Except for Sasha Vujacic.
Proven shot maker.
Vujicic.
I mean, Derrick Rose was recently asked about this.
That's a great answer. Do you want to run the triangle?
When asked if he was grown more comfortable with the triangle, his response was, bleep, do I have a choice?
Yep.
Do I have a choice? But then later he said, when you're out there, quote, I still don't have a feel for the entire offense yet, but I pick and choose while I'm out there. You think, don't F up the game. That's a great way to put it. Just don't mess up the game. Looking at a lot of film, you learn. That's not how you guys playing.
No,
they're playing from a place.
Triangle is not a thing where you can do.
No, the whole point of the triangle, if you ask, you know, you and I covered the teams running it, but also guys who really understood it, you're not supposed to be thinking at all.
No.
Like, I mean,
to get to that point requires practice and repetition and all this. When people say they're going to put in elements of the offense, like that can work, except you know, and the Lakers, like second half of games, fourth quarters, they didn't run a lot of triangle. But everybody on the team knew what it was.
No, it's a foundation that you work. It's like when improvisation happens in jazz or happens in improv. You know, you have a really specific foundation for what you're going to be doing and an intricate knowledge. And then at that point, you can break from the playbook. You know, you can break from the blueprint. But you have to
Once
have
you know the
foundation
rules, then you can
mastered.
Break them.
Exactly.
And, you know, so this is indicative more than anything. I don't think people are listening for us to break down the intricacies of that
of
word,
that.
of the triangle. And you know, I hope not, because this is a terrible podcast for that. But I think it's indicative of a Knicks team that still doesn't quite know, Andy, if it's fish or fowl.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we know it's fowl, but does it have potential to be fish? All right, you wanted to talk a little bit about Bill Paxton, who died, it was over the weekend, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was actually the day before
the Oscars.
It
was the morning of, I thought.
I think
it was the morning of.
Okay, it may have been morning of it.
Day before.
That's what I thought. It was the Saturday.
The Oscars, in my mind, begin on Saturday.
Right. And, you know, Bill Paxton was just one of those really cool actors who had a really cool career. By the way, too, I had actually just listened to Mark Maron's WTF podcast with Bill Paxton. And it was the first time even in decades, really, of watching Paxton. I'd never heard him interviewed at that length before.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that really stood out, and especially feels poignant in his unexpected death, was just how nice a guy he seemed.
So, yeah, he was one of those people that nobody in Hollywood had a bad thing to say about him, which is hard to do.
He also just seemed incredibly grateful for his career. And a lot of people may not realize this, but he began, I didn't know this, but behind the scenes working on like Roger Corman movies and stuff like that, you know, doing tech stuff. And then he sort of randomly got the opportunity that he really wanted, which was to act. And, you know, he had some luck that broke, you know, finding a kinship and an opportunity with James Cameron and some other stuff. But he's one of those guys that was like almost like a working man's character actor. You know what I mean? Because
a lot
of times you think of character actors as like these thespians. And Bill Paxton never really came off as like a thespian. But if you look at over the course of his career, he really had a wide range of roles.
And he was always interesting and fun to watch. You know, when you do Paxton, you inevitably will go back to Twister or, you know,
you can't predict it.
It just happens. You know, it's like he's not
game over, man.
Right. He's not Paul Newman, but that's not the point.
Well, and the voice is so specific too.
But, you know, you look at some of the movies that he was in. He's great in A Simple Plan.
He's so good. That's my favorite of any of his roles. For people who haven't seen, it's a Sam Raimi movie with Billy Bob Thornton and Bridget Fonda, Gary Cole, these two brothers, Billy Bob and Bill Paxton, who were very good friends in real life. In rural Minnesota, they discover a crashed plane in the middle of the snow filled with millions in drug money. They decide to keep it, and just the web of lies spins out of control with just these
As webs of lies tend to do.
Yes. What a tangled web we weave. It's just a phenomenal movie, and he's terrific.
But it's just sad. I mean, you know, I'm not like, I got frustrated by the end of 2016 that literally anytime anybody died, they were thrown in there like Zsa Zsa Gabor dies.
Yeah, I mean, and it's condolences to the Gabor family.
Okay, fine. A, you didn't know she was alive. B, it's Zsa Zsa Gabor. C, she was like 97.
Yes.
Once you get to it, no! I'm not playing that game with Zsa Zsa Gabor, but like this one, and it's obviously very sad. He was 61 years old. He was a young guy.
Yeah, complications from heart surgery.
Yeah, he's a young guy, and I hope, you know, eventually, you know, many, many, many years from now, when I die, that people can recognize the impact that you had on them by how sad they seem when you die.
Yeah.
Like the amount of just genuine sadness. We saw it during the Oscars ceremony because obviously, you know, they didn't have time to get him into the montage. They did have time to get the one guy from Australia who was actually alive into the montage, but not him. Jennifer Aniston, when she introduced that segment, the In Memoriam segment, talked about him because he wasn't in there and had obviously just died. And had a very difficult time getting through it. And around Hollywood, it was the same reaction. And just, you know, like you just don't think of that industry as being filled with really good people. And
in part because it often isn't.
It often isn't. And people who are, you know, have achieved, you know, whatever level of stardom. And, you know, Bill Paxton probably made a few million bucks a movie and he was a rich guy and all these other things and was apparently still just a wonderful person. And it was, you know, it was one of those things like, I hope people think of that about me when I'm gone.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, and this came out a lot in 2016 because there were there were a lot of deaths of like legitimately iconic artists. David
Bowie,
artists.
Prince. I mean, sure. I get all that, but not Josh Ogbonna.
No, it's fine. But what I was going to say was like, and Paxton is a reminder of this too, because he's somebody that his career took off in the 80s with like, you know, Terminator and, you know, Weird Science,
right.
Chet, you know, which probably is his best known role.
I love Weird Science.
Oh, this is a great story, by the way, that he told in the Marc Maron interview. You know the scene where the two geeks, I forgot the actor who plays Wyatt, or Garrett, whichever one is in Anthony Michael Hall. But, you know,
Gary is Anthony Michael Hall.
Wyatt. I forgot the actor's name, but they're hungover, and Chet, Bill Paxton, goes up and says, "How about a nice, greasy pork sandwich served in a dirty ashtray?" That line was improvised, and it actually came from Paxton's dad, who seemed like a real character, used to say that to Bill and his brother when he knew that they were hungover and was trying to get them sick and feel queasy, basically just effing with them. That was a line that he used to use. And like, I think he improvised a fair amount of stuff, not just in Weird Science, but like in a lot of other movies.
That's interesting. You wouldn't think of him as, you know.
Well,
Elon Mitchell Smith played Wyatt.
I will forgive myself.
Yeah. Worked since 1991 when he did an episode of Silk Stockings.
But like, you know, guys who started making their presence known in the 80s, when as a teenager in the 80s and like a product of the 80s, like started really becoming aware of like movies, like in music and TV, and like really, you really start to develop a passion for that stuff. When guys of that era that you grew up watching start dying, you start to become really aware of your own
mortality. There's no question.
Like, not to try to make it about yourself.
No, but I understand. But when David Bowie died,
yeah,
that was obviously very sad. And, you know, it was young, you know, by our standard, certainly didn't need to. He was young. David Bowie is of an era where, you know, his heyday was before I was born, you know, or certainly long before I was really aware. I mean, I caught the very, you know, Let's Dance and China Doll, or China Girl and all that, you know, which is fine. But, you know, Ziggy Stardust was before I was born. You know, when like the Brat Pack starts dying, or people start to get older and all that, like that, those are movies that, like you say, it's different when it's of your, like, we are both old enough now that we have, you know, friends whose parents, you know, it's like this stuff, you know, it's impossible not to think of yourself, your family, people around you, where you are in your life when stuff like this happens. I went to a funeral yesterday for somebody I didn't know, you know, supporting friends of ours, my wife. I didn't know the guy, but like, you see things that your friends are doing and going up, giving a eulogy for a father-in-law. And you know that those moments are coming. And we're both, you know, we're lucky, both of our parents are alive. My wife's parents are still alive, but like, you know, these things are coming, and you know that you reach a certain part of your life where changes in your life are difficult to make. And all of these things contribute to that. It's not about making it about you the sense of, but like, it's impossible to avoid
also,
that.
It's also too, I mean, you make it to a certain degree about yourself with, you know, with someone like Bowie or Prince, or, you know, we're talking about Bill Paxton, because they mattered to you.
Yeah.
I mean, like, they actually, you know, as much as somebody that you've never met, you know, can matter to you, they had influence over you. And, you know, seeing these artists and, you know, people, you know, within their art, you know, within what they did that you thought they were masterful at, seeing them go, and, you know that these are people that made you care about this stuff, you know, really, in my case, I think your case, deeply, there's something unsettling about that, you know, or at the very least, it makes you introspective. You know, with Paxton, you know, Apollo 13, Aliens, Terminator, you know, great line. I mean, it's a small role. He plays that group of punks that Schwarzenegger says to give him their clothes. He just looks at him, he's like, "Bleep you, bleep hole," and just the way he delivers it. Nightcrawler, Near Dark, Tombstone.
He ended up in a lot of stuff. I don't think he was ever would be considered a great, great actor. But he's good, and he's the kind of guy who kind of carved out a career when you.
He's
learn,
always memorable,
right? And when you learn about who the guy is, then you're excited. You're happy that he carved out a career because he was one of a person who apparently deserved it.
I'll say this too, but before we go, if you want to see Bill Paxton, I think maybe it just at his most unhinged and weird, It is, I preface this by saying, a bad movie. It's called The Dark Backward in 1991.
That's a weird movie.
It's Judd Nelson, Bill Paxton, Wayne Newton, Laura Flynn Boyle, Rob Lowe, and James Caan. I was like one of like seven people who saw this movie, and that is not an exaggeration. The movie grossed less than $29,000. Judd Nelson plays.
Interestingly enough, you paid $16,000 for your ticket.
28% of that, like $29,000, came in a $7,000 opening weekend at one theater. But Judd Nelson plays.
It was not a commercial success.
Judd Nelson just plays this painfully horrible comedian. He's like this sweaty, nervous, nebbishy mess. His career is going completely nowhere until inexplicably this third arm starts to grow out of his back. And then all of a sudden, he ends up having this hook. He changes his name to Desi the Three-Armed Wonder Comic, and he starts to take off. I'm not going to tell you how it ends, but it's also weird and as stupid as everything I've described. Paxton plays Judd Nelson's totally unhinged, lunatic friend who plays the accordion as part of his act and has this fetish for enormous women. And it's a really...
Hard to believe this didn't do well.
It's this really ridiculous role in a totally stupid, like, wannabe midnight movie classic. But Paxton is so unhinged and crazy and committed in this role. Like, I still remember him like 25 years ago in this awful, awful movie.
Yeah, I think that description is going to be as close to anybody gets to it, because it's got to be hard to find, I think, at this point.
It's around if you want to find it.
You really got to look.
Again, I preface this by saying you're not going to enjoy the movie, but you will laugh with Paxton.
All right, well, that's something to look forward to. So we'll be back with, I don't know, something at some point.
Absolutely.
You know what that is? Keeps him guessing, Andy.
Yes, it does.
All right, see everybody next time.